I'm Christopher Leighton. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This one is with a regular guy from the neighborhood, so to speak, Jeff Klein of Dorchester, Massachusetts, about a mission to Gaza, the besieged Palestinian beachhead between Egypt and Israel. Jeff Klein's excellent adventure this summer took him to see a place that most of us Americans have chosen or been persuaded to put out of mind. From Jones Hill, in the heart of the Boston melting pot, Jeff Klein is a retired machinist and union leader, an almost regular working-class hero with a highly irregular susceptibility to the suffering of strangers and a need to see things for himself. What he saw in Gaza in midsummer 2009 was resilience, as he says, amidst horrific destruction. Jeff Klein, you've had an interesting summer. You went to a place that most of us keep at a distance, emotionally, politically, even graphically. I want to know what you saw in Gaza.
Well, you know, it's hard to know where to begin. Most people listening to this will have only the vaguest idea what and where Gaza is. It's a little strip of land along the Mediterranean between Israel and Egypt. And I describe it, it's a little bit like, oddly, the Outer Cape. It's about the same size and the same sort of geography as the Outer Cape, kind of sandy seashore. It's 20 miles or so long and 4 or 5 miles wide, and 1.5 million people living in, 1.5 million Palestinians. And most of them have their roots as refugees from what is now the state of Israel. They came from the southern towns and cities in what became Israel in 1948. And right now they're living effectively under a siege perpetrated by Israel. Israel borders on Gaza two out of the four sides. The seaside is blockaded by the Israeli Navy. And there's a short border with Egypt, which is mostly shut by the Egyptians in cooperation with the Israeli authorities. So 1.5 million people are living in what is, in effect, a large open-air prison. Hmm. And the Israelis control everything that comes in and out of Gaza and are maintaining the people there essentially on a sort of subsistence diet. Especially since the Israeli attack on Gaza earlier this year. 1.5 million people kind of struggling to survive under siege. And we saw both the resilience of the people there in the face of what they're suffering, and also the horrific destruction that was wrought by Israel when it attacked Gaza in December of last year and January of this year. I have to say, one of the reasons I felt particularly it was important for me and the others in my group as Americans to go was because the pilots that flew the planes over Gaza were Israeli, but the planes and the bombs and the missiles and the helicopters were made in the United States and effectively given to the Israelis. They don't even buy them. We give them the weapons, including a large shipment of specialized bunker-busting bombs that was transported to Israel just in the months before their attack, clearly with the foreknowledge of the Bush administration that this attack was coming.
First off, why do Americans like you go to Gaza, and what were the obstacles to getting there?
It's one of those issues where once you learn about an injustice, that, especially one that is perpetrated or enabled by your own government, and in my case, perpetrated by a government who says it's acting on my behalf, you know, in Israel. Once you know about that, silence is complicity. So I've been active on this issue for a long time. When the opportunity came to do something concrete to try to crack this blockade of Gaza, I jumped at the chance. I didn't organize it, but I was happy to join it.
Jeff Klein, introduce yourself. As a human being, name, rank, serial number, work, family.
Well, I live in Dorchester. I was born and raised in New York City. I retired a few years ago after working as a machinist for most of my adult life and as a union activist. I was president of a union at the Mass Water Resources Authority for many years. I worked on Deer Island. Started working there when you had to go through the prison to get to work. saw the new plant being built. It was in the middle of that while I was working there, and then was able to retire a few years ago. I have two kids. One is just finished his first year in college, and the other one is starting college next year. And since retiring, in particular, I've been able to sort of get active in some of the things I'm passionate about, like justice and peace. And I work with this organization, Dorchester People for Peace, that I do a weekly newsletter, and I do what I can to try to make the world a better place in my small, tiny little part of it. I first really got personally involved in this issue, as opposed to sort of somewhat abstractly involved, when a friend of mine asked me, I was president of a union working at that, and a friend of mine asked me if I would help to host a tour of Palestinian union people that were coming to the United States to sort of give that perspective about it. And I hadn't been that involved. This was in 2002. I hadn't been that much involved in it. And of course, I said, yeah. And they stayed at my house, and I helped arrange a few speaking engagements for them. And I would have to say, since then, it's been very personal with me. I'm still in touch with these guys. I see them every year in the West Bank. And
what's their union?
Well,
what do they do?
Both of them used to work for the Palestinian General Confederation of Trade Unions, which is their AFL-CIO kind of thing. And both of them have been laid off. You know, under the sort of Israeli restrictions in the West Bank, the economy has gone way down. So both of them lost their jobs. One, my friend Mohammed Arouri, he lives in Ramallah, and he's active as a volunteer with an independent union organization, and he is the president of what is now the largest union in the city of Ramallah in the West Bank, the Union of Unemployed Palestinian Workers. My other friend, Abdul, is back in his village, and he basically ekes out a living through his olive trees and working at an olive press there. Mm-hmm. And I see them every year. Both of them have been in jail many times, although they're the most mild, sweet people you can imagine. I mean, I'm not naive. I like to. I think I'm a good judge of character. These are the most inoffensive, mild, sweet people you can imagine. Mohammed has been in jail 7 times under this preventive detention thing that the Israelis have, and lives pretty much in poverty. Although he's succeeded in getting an education for his children, one of whom is studying in the United States. It's very personal with me. I see them. There's also a very dear, every time I go back, these are the people I see, and plus a doctor who lives in Israel. I mean, there's a whole untold story.
So you decide to go to Gaza, of all places, in the summer of 2009. One doesn't just buy a plane ticket to Gaza. How did you get there?
You can't. Of course, you can't. This effort was organized principally by a member of parliament, a British member of parliament, George Galloway, who some of your listeners may know about. He's an amazing character in all kinds of ways. He was expelled from the British Labour Party because he was very vocal in his opposition to the Iraq War and critical of Tony Blair. And he started his own party called the Respect Party, and he's the only member of parliament for this party from East London. And many of his constituents are Muslims, as you know, England has a lot of Muslims, principally South Asians, but Arabs and all kinds. And he's developed this coalition in England, an anti-war coalition whose base is both anti-war, you know, native Britishers and Muslims. And he came to the U.S. to organize a largely symbolic effort of U.S. people to sort of break this blockade of Gaza. And his approach was to speak all over the country where there were large Arab, Muslim, and especially Palestinian-American populations. And he succeeded. And it was sort of did an end run around the normal kind of activism around this issue. And I really went to the grassroots. And the results show themselves on this convoy that I'll explain, but partly also raising money. He raised $1 million to bring humanitarian relief supplies into Gaza. And it was a huge effort, an amazing effort. In a few short weeks, this whole project was organized. And the send-off was in Brooklyn at a church, a black church in Brooklyn, addressed by a Brooklyn city councilor, Charles Barron, who's a great guy I got to know on this trip. And we were launched to Cairo on the way to Gaza. And it was a very complicated logistical plan, some of which worked, some of which didn't, mostly because of the political opposition of the Egyptian authorities. And after an epic voyage and overland, we reached Gaza, but not with everything we hoped to bring. But
you had seven trucks worth of relief supplies, whatever was in them. Did they get there?
Yes. But we had also hoped, the group had purchased 47 vehicles in the free port of Alexandria. And the original plan was the relief supplies were going to be loaded onto these vehicles. They were going to be driven to Gaza and left there because there's a huge shortage of transportation inside Gaza, because no cars or vehicles have been allowed in by the Israeli blockade for many, many years. Many of them are old and, decrepit, the ones that exist. So people can't even get around, including for medical care. So part of the plan was to bring these 47 vehicles and four ambulances over the border into Gaza. And that was thwarted, in effect, by the Egyptian authorities. So the project now owns 47 vehicles that are in the port of Alexandria and paid $500,000 for them and is in the process of negotiating whether they can get them in or get the money back and redistribute that to relief supplies.
Jeff, in a trip like this, there's always a moment when people bond, become one sort of single ship of fools and get to know each other. Then suddenly you were in Gaza through Rafah.
When we were finally allowed to go in, we got word at midnight on Tuesday, Wednesday of that week, and got up in the middle of the night to pack the buses with the relief supplies, the buses and the trucks with the relief supplies, because they were in Cairo, and then drove through the early morning and all day across northern Egypt. To get Cairo is on the Nile, and then you have to cross the Suez Canal and go all across Sinai to get to Rafah. And there are all kinds of roadblocks and everything. The whole of Sinai is regarded as a military zone by the Egyptians. So we were held up at all these roadblocks and checkpoints and so on. We didn't get to Gaza and the Gaza crossing until 6 o'clock the following day. Remember, we had been up basically for 24 hours. And then, I believe intentionally, we had this incredibly slow bureaucratic process by the Egyptian authorities to do the stamping of us to get in. It took 3.5 hours for them to stamp 200 passports. And if you watch them, it seemed clear. I mean, I'm used to some government workers are not the speediest workers in the world, but these people were painstakingly passing it back and forth and reading the names back and forth and stamping it. So here we were in this stifling kind of anteroom to Gaza. It was kind of like a prison visiting area. 3 hours, more hours, while the people on the other side had been waiting effectively for 2 days for us to arrive. Stifling hot. And many of the people with us, and I hope I'll have a chance to explain, many of the people with us were Palestinian Americans who were hoping to see relatives they had not been able to see for years and years in Gaza. And they're anxious as could be. So they held us up till after dark. And that was, I think, the strategy. So most of the welcoming crowds had gone home. There were a lot of reporters. There was an official welcome, but it was dark when we got through. But the enthusiasm was tremendous, and partly because so many of our group were Palestinian Americans, either having been born in Palestine, some in Gaza, or more the children and grandchildren of people who had left Palestine during the, what they call the Nakba, the destruction of the Palestinian communities within what became Israel. And it was exhilarating. I mean, it was something, I don't think there's ever been anything like this, but lots of people have visited Gaza and the West Bank in solidarity and tried to support the Palestinians. But this was actual Palestinians sort of coming home, in effect. Mm. And it was amazing. It was just amazing. The excitement and the enthusiasm. And as I said, to me, it was a little bit of a picture of what it would be like if and when finally the 5 million refugees from Palestine ever get to go home. It was a kind of a homecoming, even if it was temporary. 24 hours was all we had. The Egyptian authority said, if you stay 1 hour beyond 24 hours, we won't let you out. So we had a deadline. We absolutely had a deadline, which we met. We had one day, basically one full day within Gaza, and a lot was crammed into that. But unfortunately, it didn't allow the time to really get to meet and greet people in the ordinary person-to-person way. It was kind of, you know, we were taken around and had meetings, but we didn't get that real person-to-person thing, which I wish we had had if we had the 3 days that we originally had planned for.
Jeff, sketch some of those faces that are with you and outline their stories as you understood them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as I said, because of the organizing strategy of sort of trying to recruit people in the Palestinian-American communities, about two-thirds of the people, of the 200 or so people in this group, were Palestinian-Americans, and mostly on the young side. And it was something, it was a revelation to me, I can say. I mean, I've been active for a long time, and you do what you can do, but you kind of think you've seen it all, right? And this was something totally new. I mean, there were kids from the principal areas that these groups of kids came, and they knew each other, a lot of them were relatives, were northern New Jersey, Brooklyn, and Southern California. And of course, there were some middle-aged people that I got to know and some older people who were going back. But the real revelation was these young, enthusiastic grandchildren of the Nakba, effectively, who, by the way, were not activists in general. They weren't your normal run-of-the-mill sort of college activists. They were very, they had this connection, even though they were maybe a generation or two removed, they had this connection with the land of Palestine. Most of them were Muslims, and most of them were religious. It was amazing. And because we had all this time trying to get around the bureaucratic delays, we had a lot of time to get to know each other while we were waiting around. And I have to say, for me, that was the real revelation of this trip. I speak a few words of Arabic, more than most Americans. So I became kind of the American uncle to a lot of these kids. And I was loving it. I was just loving it. I got to know them. I got to know their stories. And it's...
For example?
Well... there were so many. One kid, Mohammed from Milwaukee, right? He was a community college student. His family had been expelled from southern Israel into Gaza. Eventually, his own parents made their way to the United States, but he had close relatives in Gaza that he'd never seen. And he was going to see them. There was another kid, Nasser, from, of course, he had a very popular name in Egypt, by the way, Nasser. And he was from a student at Berkeley and also going to see Palestine for the first time. His parents originally were some from the West Bank, some from Nazareth, which is in Israel, present-day Israel. There were middle-aged people from a couple that I really got there. While we were in Cairo, I'm not that young myself, so besides being the uncle to these kids...
You look young to me.
Thank you. Besides being the uncle to these kids, I was also the brother to some of the more middle-aged people who were also going to see relatives in Gaza. And we'd smoke a water pipe every night near our hotel in Giza, where we stayed. And I got to know their story. So Palestinians in particular are, they're incredibly focused on education. So the ones here, the young people were all in school or had been to school. The older people are all professionals of one kind or another, engineers, doctors, accountants. And so Mohammed, who was going to see his 90-year-old mother, he's an environmental consultant from Illinois. And he and another fellow from Tampa, Florida, Abdul Rauf, who calls himself Ralph, was going to see his mother and his brother in Gaza. And the most sort of heartrending, Maher, who was an engineer in Kansas City, originally from Gaza, U.S. citizen, had gone back to Gaza when it was open with his family, all U.S. citizens, his wife and four small children. And then he had left to come back for his job, expecting to bring his family over shortly. And then the siege, the Israeli-Egyptian siege began, and his family, all American citizens, were effectively trapped in Gaza, and they could not get out. And he was going both to see them, he hadn't seen them in over a year, and to try to bring them out. And all of them, I mean, the sort of amazing thing, all of them said they didn't contact their relatives and tell them they were coming because they were uncertain whether we'd get in or not. I mean, this was a big, up until the last minute, we didn't know if we'd get into Gaza. And they didn't want to disappoint them, if they didn't want to get their hopes up. And you'd say, well, traveling 3,000 miles to see people and you don't tell them you're coming, what's that? Well, of course, the irony is there's no place to go in Gaza. You can't be out of town if someone visit you in Gaza. So they didn't tell their relatives they were coming until we actually crossed over the border. And Maher had this horrific story, I think, it's worth telling. He brought his family. When we left after 24 hours, we were leaving, and he brought his wife and small children with him on the bus from Gaza City, which is in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, to Rafah, the border with Egypt in the south, and in the hopes of bringing them out with him. And the Egyptian authorities were very careful. They went over a list of every passport, and the only people who could get out were people who had been signed in with our group. And at the border, there was this horrific confrontation. Here he was with his wife and small children and told that they couldn't leave. He could leave, but they couldn't leave.
What are their passports?
U.S. They're U.S. citizens. His children were all born in the U.S., and his wife is a naturalized American citizen.
Wow.
And he had to decide. I mean, he was pleading with the Egyptian authorities, trying to do what he could, trying not to get really angry, because Palestinians really have to learn that getting angry is very dangerous for them. But being, you could see, just very emotional. And in the end, he decided the only thing he could do was leave himself and hope to go to Cairo and make some arrangements to get some pressure from the U.S. Embassy to get them out. And that's what he did. He was in tears. His children were hysterical, losing their father. They were young. They were four. The oldest one looked to be around 11 or 12. And this was our departure from Gaza. I mean, it was just really shit. And I'd gotten to know this guy really well while we were trying to get in. And I just still don't know right now what happened, whether he got his family out. I hope he did, but I'm not that optimistic. Part of our experience was the U.S. Embassy was anything but very helpful for our effort, I have to say. I hope that things are going to change. I mean, Obama has spoken up about in favor of loosening the blockade around Gaza for humanitarian reasons, if nothing else. And just yesterday, I mean, it was somewhat encouraging. Just yesterday, there was an article in the Israeli newspapers that said for the first time they were going to allow some limited amount of construction material back into Gaza, because this was the horror of it. They not only destroyed a good portion of Gaza, then they embargoed any material for reconstruction. Mm-hmm. So if you go around and see the destruction, they were just piles of rubble, piles of concrete rubble, and not a stick of rebar or concrete to do anything about it. And just yesterday, they announced that they were loosening it up a little bit. And I attribute that to public pressure around the world, including this modest efforts that we took also. Bad publicity.
Light dawns on Gaza for you for the first time. What did you see? What did you see 6 months after this, I must say, unmerciful shelling of certain parts of that city?
Right. Well, you know, of course, we arrived at night, and we drove the length of Gaza at night, didn't see anything. And we stayed at this hotel, the Commodore Hotel, I should say, on the seashore of Gaza City. And, you know, in the immediate vicinity of this hotel, you didn't see much evidence of destruction. This was downtown Gaza, so to speak, very crowded, very built up. And the first thing we did that morning, we got on some buses and went on a tour. And that's where you began to see the destruction. The outskirts of Gaza in the direction of the border with Israel is a neighborhood called Jabalia. And that was totally demolished. It was mostly mixed housing and industry. And it wasn't quite as densely built up as the downtown of Gaza, but every building and every workshop and every factory was a pile of rubble, every single one destroyed. And it was completely evident. I mean, anyone who followed the lead up to this Israeli attack, it was evident that this was not a military operation in the sense that it was to confront a military force. It was a punitive operation, in effect, to get the population to sort of change its mind. So it was a calculated effort to destroy the commercial infrastructure of Gaza and also the government administrative infrastructure. So outside of this industrial area where everything was destroyed, in Gaza City itself, only individual buildings were targeted. What was targeted? Every government and administrative center in the Gaza Strip, the Ministry of Justice, the executive office, the Parliament building. We had a meeting with the parliamentarians who remain at large. These were the ones who were elected in 2006 in what was regarded as the freest election that's ever been in the Middle East by international observers. And you recall the Hamas party, which actually was the Reform and Change Party, by the way. They didn't run as Hamas. They were the Reform and Change Party got a plurality of the vote. And when the Legislative Council was convened, they chose Ismail Haniyeh, who was the head of Hamas, as the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority. I mean, of the sort of, if they had a country, he would be the prime minister of it. We don't recognize him. Israel doesn't recognize him. We recognize Mahmoud Abbas, who is the elected president of the Palestinian Authority, but whose term ran out in January.
Of course, Hamas did not meet the standards of civility and other prerequisites for that the United States government thought were important. What was your judgment of the politics of Hamas that you could see?
Well, of course, I should say to start with that I'm not a supporter of Hamas. I'm not a supporter of any sort of religiously based party in Palestine or Israel or the United States or anywhere else. I do support people's democratic right to choose who they want to represent them. And I think Hamas, beyond, you know, the things that are legitimate to criticize about it, I think Hamas has been vilified way beyond what's rational by the Israelis and the U.S. government, not primarily because of their religious orientation, but in my belief, because of their orientation to resistance. You know, I believe if you support democracy, you have to support people's right to choose, and that even when they choose in a way that you don't agree, it doesn't negate their right to a democratic choice or self-determination. You know, if we hold this standard that people have to live up to some, you know, lofty moral and ethical standard in order to deserve freedom, then, you know, we have to look at ourselves. I mean, did we deserve it? We had slavery when we became a free country. By that standard, we didn't deserve, you know, the British should have kept ruling America because we weren't worthy of being independent. And you could go on and on in history.
What was your estimate close up of Ismail Haniyeh?
Yeah, you know, obviously it was a formal meeting, but he struck me as a very modest guy. His trappings of office were very modest, although he had a lot of security around him. He is the most wanted. This is a man who is living under the imminent threat of assassination by the Israeli authorities every day and every night. But within that, when he met with us, he was a very modest man. He mingled with our group, you know, pressed the flesh. And he made a big point. I didn't mention this. Among our group were four ultra-Orthodox rabbis from this group in a town in upstate New York. And they call themselves Neturei Karta. I don't know exactly what that means. But they're, you know, if you imagine that traditional Eastern European Hasidic dress, the big hats, the beards, the curls on the sides, long black coats. There were four of them with us, and they sat on the podium with Ismail Haniyeh. And they are uncompromising in their anti-Zionism. They're profoundly religious and profoundly anti-Zionist. And
did they explain to you?
Yes. I actually had a chance. I mean, one of the wonderful things of this kind of thing, I actually sat with these four guys a number of times while we were waiting around, and talk to them a lot. And they, you know, their belief is that Israel as a secular state is a contradiction to the word of the scripture, where the state, the revival of the state of Israel can only come through God and the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah. And this was my understanding is this was a fairly common view among ultra-Orthodox Jews in the early years of Israel. Many of them did not recognize the secular state of Israel. And along the years, a lot of the groups within Israel like that have been sort of won over, in effect, by political means, economic means. You know, they're subsidized by the state. But these guys are uncompromising. And they wear, on their black caftans, they have these big square sort of placards that say, a Jew, not a Zionist, in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. So they sat on the stage next to Haniyeh, and he made a big point of referring to them and saying he wanted to be absolutely clear that his fight, Hamas's fight, and the Palestinians' fight was not with Jews as a religious people, but with Zionism as a political movement. And there was this warm exchange between them that was quite something to see, even just visually because of the contrast. Haniyeh with his trimmed beard and he's an athletic young middle-aged guy, and these four rabbis in their Hasidic getup. And then we met and greeted. You know, he went through the crowd like any politician. And these young Palestinians that I was with kind of looked at him like a rock star. I said it was like, you know, everyone wanted to press his flesh, get pictures taken with him. And I didn't succeed. I almost succeeded in getting a picture taken with him, but not quite. And then we had other meetings too. We met in the parliament. We met in the ruins of the parliament with the highest ranking parliamentarian that is at liberty. The speaker of the parliament was in jail in Israel. This was the deputy speaker that addressed us and a few other parliamentary. We met in kind of a tent in the ruins of the parliament building. And then we had a meeting. I expect that the Palestinian Authority is probably the only governing authority that has a ministry of detainees because there are 12,000 or so Palestinians who are detained in Israel at any one time. And ministering to their families, trying to get messages to and from them, and agitating for their release is the job of this ministry. And we heard a lot of personal stories from people who hadn't seen their relatives. In this case, the people who are jailed by Israel are taken back into Israel in, you know, 1948 Israel, and their relatives can't visit them. If they're Palestinians coming from the West Bank of Gaza, their relatives can't visit them. In many cases, it's been decades since they've seen their husbands, fathers, and so on.
Jeff Klein, this gets more and more surreal, I must say, as you go on. I mean, these parliamentarians standing in the rubble, or a politician sort of working the crowd, but knowing he's under assassination threat all the time. What were you making of this scene as a story?
Well, of course, you know, this is a story you have to, you know, follow by knowing the history, learning the history. I mean, it wasn't something you could see on the ground, except what you could see, of course, was the disproportionate destruction that was, you know, wrought by the Israelis against the Palestinians compared to what the pictures we've seen of the damage they had done to Israel. But you have to go back a little bit. Israel basically put Gaza under siege in 2006, 2007.
After withdrawing its own settlements.
Yes. And, you know, this was, I think everyone who looks at it understands, this was a kind of strategic move on the part of Ariel Sharon. It was very costly to maintain these few thousand Israeli settlers in the middle of 1.5 million people in Gaza. It was costly in terms of the military expenditure. It was complicated for them to fight and punish the Palestinians in Gaza when they had their own people living in the middle. So it was a kind of strategic move to withdraw the thousands of settlers outside of Gaza and then sort of lock it up and squeeze it as a result. So some Israelis say the occupation ended, but of course it didn't, because Israel controls all the borders of Gaza, including the sea. I mean, there's a fishing industry. There used to be a fishing industry in Gaza. It has, you know, along the 120-mile border is the Mediterranean Sea. There's a port. They're not allowed to fish except within a mile or two of the shore. And, of course, that's all fished out. If they venture out further, the Israeli Navy, which patrols up and down the shore, shoots at them. There's an airport in Gaza, which is closed. They're not allowed to use. So the occupation continues in other ways. You know, there are not Israeli settlers inside Gaza, but effectively the occupation continued. And by international law, Israel is still the belligerent occupier, which is the term of art in international law, and is responsible for the welfare of the civilian population inside Gaza. So it's occupation by other means, in effect. So what was the response? The people in Gaza, their demand was basically, we're glad you left. And we did actually drive through some of what had been former Israeli settlements in Gaza. We're glad you left. But now we just want the freedom to trade and have contact with the outside world, you know. And until Israel allows that, they're still occupying. They're not looking, the people in Gaza, they say, we don't need handouts from anyone. We just need to have access to the world. There's a tremendously entrepreneurial Palestinian diaspora that would love to help. The Palestinians themselves have a high level of education. They just want access to the world, and this is what they're being denied by Israel. So they hit back in whatever way they could. They sent these rockets over, of course, targeting, they don't target civilians so much as being random, you know, and not able to untarget civilians. And of course, you know, that's not something that people of goodwill can support. You can understand it maybe, but you can't support it.
What do you take to be the Gazan's logic in twisting the lion's tail? And then what is the lion's logic in this huge overkill?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I'm not privy to their thinking, but people want to resist, even if it's only symbolic, and sometimes they do it in ways that are hurtful to themselves, you know, because the emotional need to defy, to hit back is very strong. They certainly, this policy of these rockets definitely did in the long run more harm to the people of Gaza than to the people of Egypt, of Israel, no question. But it's understandable, right? People want to strike back, and that's what they did. But I think their preference was, and they showed it, to negotiate a truce. And they have negotiated many truces with Israel, and if you follow the history very carefully, invariably it was the Israelis that broke every truce between the Palestinians, and especially Hamas and Israel. And why? I mean, the fundamental issue, if you look, to my view, if you look at the history of this conflict and where it stands today, the Israelis fundamentally do not want a peaceful outcome. A peaceful outcome means relinquishing some of the control over the territory that they control. And I think the consensus in Israel is one way or another, we would prefer war or an uneasy semi-war to a peace that involves retreat. And that's my view. And I think if you look dispassionately at the history, you'll see that, it's about keeping control over the whole of Palestine from the Jordan River to the sea. And I hope, and I don't think they're likely to change that policy through their internal political process. If change is going to come, it's going to come through pressure from outside, which I'm happy to see Obama has started to apply, and some of our allies in Europe have started to apply some pressure, but it's still very tentative. And I don't think, it's not clear that there's the political will in this country or the ability to put enough pressure on Israel to alter their behavior. I hope there is, but I'm not sure.
Jeff, what did you learn about what sustains these Palestinians in isolation, in poverty, in eternal resistance, in considerable danger, with no light in that tunnel? What keeps them there?
You know, I wish I knew. It's a miracle that they have been able to sustain their sort of national identity amid generations of hardship, of a diaspora around the world, and the second and third generation in the United States, who've never even been to Palestine, have this strong sense of identity with their, you know, the land of their ancestors. You know, it's a little bit ironic that in some ways the Palestinians of today are what the Jews were of yesterday. There's this oppression, and the diaspora has kind of somehow made them stronger. Adversity has made them stronger, and I'm constantly amazed not only that they are so steadfast, and that's a word that they use. Sumud is an Arabic word which you'll learn if you go to the West Bank. Sumud means steadfastness, sticking to it. They have that, and they have a kind of determination and a calmness about it, which is quite remarkable. I mean, I always, whenever I visit the West Bank and I have friends there, I always feel that I'm the angriest person on the scene among my Palestinian friends. They have a calm kind of, they're in it for the duration, and that getting angry doesn't help. So they're calm and determined, and of course to me, I'm more of an American, right? We want instant gratification, and I'm furious. Well, I'm furious every time I get to an Israeli checkpoint with my friends and see what people undergo. I'm angry, but they're calm and steadfast. And of course, if they get angry, it could cost them their lives. So it is a different situation. I have my American passport to protect me, and they don't.
Jeff, you have the remnants of a New York manor. You have a Jewish name. What does your own ancestry, your own identity, have to do with all of this?
Well, of course, it's a complicated question. I grew up in New York. My parents and grandparents were all Eastern European immigrants, Jewish immigrants, as they understand it, Yiddish-speaking. My father was born near Kiev, died when I was very young. I grew up thinking I was Jewish. I mean, it wasn't a religion. It was a kind of ethnicity that seemed natural. So if people ask me, what are you? I say, human.
When people on the trip or otherwise say, Jeff Klein, are you Jewish? Mm-hmm. What do you answer? And what has that had to do with what you saw?
Uh-huh. Well, the short answer I usually give is that my parents were Jewish, but I'm not. Because I, you know, maybe this is a very American view, right? We choose our identities. We create ourselves. My parents thought of themselves as Jewish, and that was legitimate. That was who they are. They came, they spoke Yiddish, they came from villages in Eastern Europe. I don't think of myself that way. And I've spoken, I have a lot of Palestinian friends, and I've once or twice I've spoken a little more at length on this issue, and I have to say, you know, when I look at Palestine, and I feel I do have a connection with the people there, and frankly, it's the Palestinians. If I had to say, who are my people in Palestine? My people are the Palestinians.
And do you connect that to your Jewish history?
Well, I connect it with the idea that, to the degree there's a thread of Jewish history of persecution and a sort of universalist response to persecution. It means identifying with the persecuted and not with the persecutors. I mean, if that history has any meaning, ethical meaning, and to me, the way it plays out is that my Jews are the Palestinians.
Not to be too personal about it, but do your friends and relations accept that? Is this a controversial point, or is this Jeff being Jeff, or what?
Yes, I would say it's controversial. I mean, you know, I have a lot of friends. By the way, I should say that among the sort of non-Arabs who are active in the sort of Palestinian freedom movement, promoting rights for Palestinians, there are lots of Jews who are responding in their own way out of what they think is the sort of Jewish ethical tradition, and I respect that enormously. And I think it's important for the politics of this issue, for people who are just learning about it, to see that it's not anti-Jewish. At least many people believe it's not anti-Jewish to be pro-Palestinian.
For your friends and neighbors, Jeff, who don't know this subject inside out, what's the moral you brought home from Gaza in summer 2009?
The neighbors say you went to Gaza, and how do I respond? Well, you know, it's odd. I have to say, you know, to people who are not politically active, it's something odd. It's not in the ordinary. So it takes a little bit of explaining. But people that you have a relationship with, your neighbors, there's a level of, they're prepared to listen to you in a way that they wouldn't otherwise. So, you know, I'm just the other day, I'm talking to my neighbor across the street, and how did it go? What did you see? And, you know, and I think it's the human, it's the personal stories that people can hear. People who are not prepared to say have the political kind of analysis or knowledge, the personal stories. People, my neighbor knows now that his tax money is going to buy bombs to kill people in Gaza, and he doesn't like it. He doesn't like it, and that's the reaction I generally have. If you can get their ear, we didn't pull the trigger, but it was our bombs that did it. And I think that's the key thing for Americans, that we are complicit in this destruction. You know, I mean, every house that was, every factory that was destroyed in Gaza was destroyed with our being enabled by us. And again, all of us are kind of outraged, especially the non-Palestinians. And, you know, we got to do something about it. We got to change this. Now, there are only so many people I can speak to in my neighborhood or otherwise. Getting an audience for this is not so easy. But when you talk to people about it, I find they're universally understanding and sympathetic about this issue, because as human beings, we, you know, there's an empathy that we have with people who are suffering. And if you make them human, people will respond as human beings. And in order to for people to accept the brutality against another people, part of it involves them not considering them fully human. You know, I mean, because we can't, as human beings, we can't be that cruel to people whose humanity we recognize, you know, we identify with.
Jeff Klein, you're a pretty sweet, mild guy yourself. You've had an exotic experience, and it's shocking, though, how simply human it is when you tell it as straight as you do.
It's interesting to hear you call me so mellow and laid back. In my days as a union president, the management, when I had to negotiate with them, used to consider me something of a vocal opponent. I guess it's my being retired for a few years and having contact with my Palestinian friends, I've learned the value of steadfastness, as they call it, as opposed to anger. I mean, I went on this as a mission to do some good, but I have to say, I got so much out of it myself. I mean, stuff that, we stayed while we were cooling our heels, waiting for the permission to go. We were in Giza. I walked to the pyramids from there, you know, and I never imagined in my life that I would go to the pyramids, you know, and I went. I had a great experience. I went the first morning we were there with this bunch of young Palestinian kids. Again, I was, you know, this was right from day one. I was the uncle. I was the American uncle. And we rode around the pyramids on horses and camels, you know. And I had another thing I didn't talk about. I was part of this group who could drive standard shift cars who went to Alexandria to pick up the vehicle. So we went to Alexandria, which I had never, you know, I mean, I never imagined going to. Alexandria is such an amazing, amazing place, you know. Have you ever been? It's just, there's this wonderful Greek Alexandrian poet named Constantine Cavafy, who I love, I really love. And his house is a museum. I got, you know, totally, you know, while we're waiting around to get these cars out of the port, I went to Gavafi's house and had a great conversation with the caretaker of the house, who was an Egyptian Arab working for the Greek embassy. And I sat in Gavafi's chair, you know, and read some of his poetry. He's a wonderful, wonderful poet. And that was, again, a bonus, a sort of unanticipated bonus. Another, you know, joy of this thing. I have to say joy. Can you say joy in the middle of someone else's misery? You know, I'm a little embarrassed. That's why I didn't talk about it sooner. I mean, it seems a little bit unfair to get enjoyment out of trying to alleviate some people's misery, you know, but I did. I had a wonderful time. It's the joys of travel, you know, the joys of a journey, I think. If you know Cavafy at all? Yeah.
By reputation, and there's a recent big collection of his work.
Yes, yes. Daniel Mendelsohn wrote a new translation.
Exactly.
And he has a great poem called Ithaca, and it's essentially instructions to Odysseus to say, it's the journey that counts. Don't worry so much about getting there, because that doesn't mean much. It's the process of getting there and what you'll see along the way. It's a great, great poem. You should read Cavafy sometime. So it meant a lot to me to you know, be physically in the presence of this guy. And then I had a great conversation with this Arab caretaker who I brought my Cavafy book with me. So I should show you. I got this great inscription from, I brought it in case you were interested. This was from the caretaker, and I got one of the people to translate it for me. When I was there.
This is the caretaker at Cavafy's house,
yeah,
and he writes
yeah.
to you in Arabic, but it's been translated, from a human being who was born in an area which is turbulent and full of problems, who has struggled since birth with bad news every day, and I keep asking myself how long I will be hearing bad news. I found the answer with common sense and logic, that each human should respect the other regardless of ethnicity, color, or belief. God has created us to choose. He didn't create to choose for us. All the thanks to Mr. Jeff and Mr. Galloway for all their good deeds in the path of goodness and love, Muhammad El Said.
Can you beat that? Can you beat that? So, you know, I feel blessed, right? I mean, what could be better than doing something good and also having some good, you know?
Jeff, thank you for sharing with us what you did this summer.
Thank you.
Walker Metling recorded and edited this conversation with Jeff Klein. Samantha Allen assembled a slideshow of Jeff's pictures for our website. Check them out and leave a comment about Gaza, what you know or don't know, what you need or want to know, at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for joining the conversation.